example of a parallel threat on a global, national, or even local scale. Too latency invites disaster. I'm going to jump to the bottom. A worldwide strategic mobilization similar to the effort required by World War II must be developed in the weeks ahead. Now, that one's about Y2K. Everybody's forgotten Y2K, so let me remind you what was predicted 6 years ago. This authority says things are only going to get more confusing, absolute certainty will never come, but he predicts at least a 12-month disruption of basic goods and services, including no electrical power, no clean water, no telecommunications, shortages of food, gas, clothing, widespread bank failures, stock market crash, dramatic drop in real estate values, economic depression, widespread unemployment, civil unrest, riots, and general lawlessness. This is actually one of the more conservative estimates. Here's one that predicts a meltdown of civilization as we know it. Can't get any stronger than that. What actually happened? Well, as we know, it's actually nothing. But notice the urgent language. The situation is desperate, unprecedented action is necessary, ordinary values have to be pushed aside, and anyone who disagrees is dangerous and reactionary. Terror, fear, and the end of civilization. Now you may be thinking, wait a minute, Y2K was a real problem, and the concerns, even if they were exaggerated, nevertheless mobilized people and led to success. This is a common but totally erroneous view. Here's the UN again. During the first months of the new century, only minor problems were reported. The governments can congratulate themselves for passing the Y2K challenge. Governments can congratulate themselves. The only problem is they have no reason to congratulate themselves because the governments didn't solve the problem. U.S. government, for example, spent about $6 billion, but Citibank alone spent nearly $1 billion. And total U.S. expenditures were $100 billion, which means that the government spent 6% of the total. There's no way to look at it. Now, would Citibank have spent the money to fix its Y2K problem without government urging? Of course, because not to do so would have put them out of business. The same with other banks and businesses around the world. Yet government takes the credit. Here again is the U.S. government contribution here. Now, to encourage what is happening anyway is a common procedure in many areas of advocacy. For example, it now seems clear that despite the warnings of Paul Ehrlich and others, we are not going to have a population explosion of 14 billion people and mass starvation. How do we avoid this explosion? Because, the head of Planned Parenthood once explained to me, because everybody in the world listened to Ehrlich and got busy stopping population growth. This is a view that only an academic can hold. I was astonished that she could be so uninformed about her own particular subject area. Ehrlich may be a celebrity in the West. He was on the Johnny Carson show something like 25 times. But his advocacy had little to do with solving the problem of population because that problem was already being solved by itself by the time he wrote the book. Here's a graph from the World Bank. It's not very easy to understand, but then it's from the World Bank. Now, notice here, 1968, when Ehrlich publishes his book. The birth rate is falling, the death rate is falling, it's flat for developed countries. So in effect, fertility is being reduced and has been reduced for about 10 years. So Ehrlich is urging people to do what they're already in the process of doing for about a decade. It's not clear to me whether he knew this or not, but certainly when he said the battle to feed all of humanity is over, at this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. But he was simply wrong. As you see, after his book appeared, the death rate fell in developing countries and was flat in in the developed countries. Now this kind of a message, crying out in desperation to urge what's already happening, isn't unique. We have a contemporary example of the call of politicians and activists to end our dependence on fossil fuels and move to a carbon-neutral lifestyle. The call to action is, however, just a bit late. According to Jesse Ostervel of the Rockefeller Institute, the industrialized nations have been decarbonizing their energy sources for 150 years, meaning that we are moving away from carbon toward hydrogen. In other words, the ratio of carbon to hydrogen decreases as you go from wood and hay, which is about 1:1, to coal, to oil, to gas, where it's 1:4. Here's an illustration from one of Ostervel's articles. Hydrogen is in blue, and whatever color this looks like to you is carbon in blue. And you can see coal has more carbon per ratio of carbon atoms to hydrogen. Oil, it's changed, and here in natural gas, there's 4 hydrogen atoms to 1 carbon atom. Ostervel expects this trend will continue through this century as we move toward a pure hydrogen and its energy source, and this will happen without the assistance of lawyers and activists. Obviously, if a trend has been continuously operating since the days of Lincoln and Queen Victoria, it probably does not need the assistance of organizations like the Sierra Club and the NRDC, which are showing up about 100 years too late. Ostervel's ideas are controversial to some, but not to some sites like Sustainability Now. And this is a restatement of what happens as we go from wood to coal to oil to natural gas to pure hydrogen. Not everybody agrees that we're going to a pure hydrogen economy, but also Ostervel is a smart guy and he's studied this for a long time. Okay, then in summary, when I went back to look at all the fears, the first thing I found was that newspapers were empty, essentially. The second thing I found was that the language was uniformly and excessively frightening. And the third thing I found was that a lot of advocacy was encouraging what was happening anyway. But I learned some other things, too. One interesting feature is the tendency to reversals. A benefit becomes a hazard and then becomes a benefit again. Butter is good, then it's bad, then it's good. Saccharin is good, then it's bad, then it's okay. But this also happens for some much larger spheres, like cancer power lines, which hit the media in 1989. Before 1989, there were books like this. Where is it? Here. Which talked of magnetic fields as necessary for life. Then in 1989, Paul Broder's articles in the New Yorker magazine, that very reliable source of pseudoscientific fear-mongering down through the decades, came out with Currents of Death. This strong position drew support. And we had consumers go out to the issues and how to protect ourselves from electromagnetic fields. Then a funny thing happened. About a decade later, magnetic fields were rehabilitated. You can chart that rehabilitation here. That was 97, healing with magnets. Energy, the scientific basis for energy medicine. Magnet therapy, it's getting kind of sexy now as you see. And finally, electromagnetic healing, so we're esoteric. Okay, and in the final kind of reversal, we have this ad here, which offers to help you to sleep on magnets because since nature is drastically depleted, this environmental supplement is incredibly important. So we're trying to increase our exposure to magnetic fields. And so we've completed the circle from fear to selling point, from magnetic fields that are too powerful for health to fields that are too weak for health. Of course, rather than buying these magnets, you could just stand alongside a power line. or sit with your back to a TV set. Snuggle up to a kitchen appliance. There's lots of ways to increase your exposure to healthful magnetic fields. I'm reviewing these past theories not really to make fun of them, but because I think this back and forth quality of fears that suddenly rise and subside is symptomatic of a deeper problem with modern environmental thinking, a problem that we have to fix. Meanwhile, though, the fears continue to rise and fall. Let's look at some graphs of past fears. To get a rough idea of the visibility of these fears, I did a word search on Nexus for two newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times. These provide very rough measures, but they'll certainly show you a trend. Here, for example, is the graph for parallel lines in cancer. Number of articles on the subject in those two newspapers. So as you can see, there's a peak following Broder's book, where is it here, 89. Then it drops off with some skepticism. Then there's a lot of studies being done, a lot of talk. And over time, there's this kind of slow decline in interest. There's a similar sort of pattern we see for the population explosion. Now, this may not be quite as clear to you, but we can run a five-year average for the New York Times, and that will show you exactly how interest is going. After a peak, it's really starting to decline. And if this were a graph of stock, this means sell the stock. Here's Y2K. Now. This is fabulous. A sudden spike. Okay. The Washington Post is actually running two articles a day on Y2K. And it drops like a dead bird. And the reason why it trails along over here is for two reasons. First of all, there's a band called Y2K. And second, there's a steady trickle of self-congratulatory articles in which people say it's wonderful that we stopped the dreaded crisis in time. But beyond any given crisis, I want to point out this pattern. The fears rise and they fall to be replaced by other fears that rise and fall. As Mark Twain said, I've seen a heap of trouble in my life, and most of it never came to pass. I've suggested that it's the pattern in itself is indicative of the problem of how we approach the environment. So let's talk for a little bit about that. Environmental disputes frequently revolve around conflicts of land use, triggered by fear.